inviting me. This is shaping up to be a good.
Actually, I think we begged you to come. That's not the same as inviting.
You paid me money too, but
yes.
So thanks for inviting me. This is shaping up to be a good workshop. I hope to have a good time. What I'll do is I'll introduce another set of ideas or topics along the lines of consumers of document space. Meaning once you have a good representation and once you know how to manipulate them, I'm one of the people who could use them for something else. Which is also another way of saying, well, think of yet another thing when you build document spaces. Because there's yet another application. And that has to do with statistical language modeling. Right? So what is statistical language modeling all about? It's a key component of all sorts of language technologies. So if you want to do speech recognition, meaning you want to talk to your machine and have it recognize even what you said, or do translation, or some of the things that people do in information, even the little things, you know, when you type on your Windows machine and it sort of occasionally tries to correct your spelling, sometimes to your annoyance, it's using some sort of model of what the word ought to be and what you type doesn't fit what's in its list of valid words, what should it substitute it with. It uses some notion of what words might follow up. So here is a little picture of what a speech recognizer might do and where it uses a statistical language model. So this is based on this communication theoretic idea of some signal is observed, which is a noisy version of what you really wanted to get, and then you're to infer what was said. So typically it goes something like, here's the speaker's mind, and the speaker thinks up of some word sequence W to speak. And then it goes through the speaker's vocal apparatus and some pressure wave S comes out. And this is what your microphone picks up. And then there is some acoustic processor which does some signal processing, extracts some features from it which are perhaps inspired by psychoacoustics, meaning like, you know, hearing physiology and so on, sort of telling you what kind of thing the ear might pay attention to. And you get sort of a vector of features, and typically in modern recognizers, this is one every 10 milliseconds, so these are 70 seconds frames, and the dimensionality might be anything from 12 to 50, and these are real valued vectors, and you get a train of them. So A represents the whole sequence, and then what you have is a little task here to figure out, based on these acoustic vectors, what words might have gone in, and this is essentially the box that we'll pay attention to. Right? So the typical formula, or at least a simplified version of it, goes, find me W star, which maximizes the posterior probability of W given A. So the most likely words that could have been spoken given the A that I observe. And if I use Bayes' rule, do some little arithmetic, drop the P of A in the denominator because I'm looking for the R max over the W's, I get something like this. So this part over here is called the acoustic model. So this is sort of the classic analysis by synthesis idea. So this model says, if I wanted to say W, what kind of acoustics would I get? And on this continuous space of acoustics, this typically puts some densities, Gaussians, mixtures of Gaussians, and hidden Markov models are used in here. Mm-hmm. And this then becomes your a priori model of what kind of word sequences might come out. And so you would want this model. Now this is, mind you, a model on word sequences, so the set of all finite length sequences, and it's a probability distribution on them. And this is what we would call a language model, or a statistical language model. So this ought to give high probability to perhaps grammatical sentences, high probability to perhaps meaningful sentences, or maybe just frequent sentences. So that's the idea of this model over here, and typically this model gets estimated from data. So what is the state of the art? Well, unfortunately, it's not too good, or at least not too smart. It's pretty good, but it's not very smart. So the best models that are out there and used in most commercial systems are some variations on Markov processes. So they're finite memory processes, and you typically say the probability of an n-length sequence is modeled by a time homogeneous Markov chain, and it's just a product of WT given T minus one, or maybe condition on two words, sometimes on three words. And these typically have names, like if it is conditioned on the last two words, meaning it's a model based on word triples, it would be called a trigram. If there were two, it would be called a bigram. If there were four, probably four gram. But that's pretty much the most fancy things people have done to date. And everybody recognizes that this is an awful model, but I'll tell you briefly that not a whole lot does better, and there are a couple of people in the room who will talk, is it tomorrow or the day after? Tomorrow. Who will tell you what else can be done beyond this. But today, let's assume that this is the state of the art. It's not very far from it. These probabilities are typically estimated in a non-parametric way, meaning this W lives in the vocabulary of 10, 20, 50,000 words. So this is essentially a probability mass function on a set of size 50,000, and it's a conditional probability. And so you basically estimate a 50,000 dimensional vector file. That's pretty much what's done. And of course, there's acute data sparseness. Well, think about it. The vocabulary size can be 10 to 100,000. And even if you look at a fairly large corpus, and then you look at some held out data, so you've looked at 100 million words of newswire text from the New York Times, and you look at tomorrow's New York Times, and you look at a few articles, you'll find about a third of the word triples in that article are things you've never seen before. And it's amazing how rich language is and how people make up new sentences all the time. So you're going to get a lot of cases where you wouldn't have seen this particular event, if you will, if you want to think in terms of probability and events. And the other thing, of course, is that this, if this is not bad enough, we also know that, of course, statistical dependence in a sentence doesn't stop after three words. I mean, you don't pick your next word out of a bag of words, right? So clearly there are syntactic dependencies. You want to make grammatical sentences. And more importantly, there are semantic dependencies. I mean, your whole sentence or paragraph or discourse means something. Like, you know, somebody, you're trying to communicate an idea. And none of that is in this model. It's a very local chopped up model. So what I'll talk about today is a few feeble attempts, and they're really feeble attempts. I think a lot more can be done. But they're the best attempts to date of how to try and infuse some notion of long distance dependence or some notion of semantic cohesion or consistency in this model. So if I condition the last two words to be of the, what's the next word that follows? Of the what? Well, typically there's very little information in off the to say that, except perhaps that the next word might be some noun or some adjective followed by a noun or something. But the extended discourse would give you a fairly good idea of what kinds of nouns and adjectives might come in that case. Right, so that's what we'll try to do today. All right, so topic modeling. So what was done in the beginning? People recognized this immediately, said, oh, okay, there are all these people in IR who know how to cluster documents into topics. So what should we do? They said, well, let's do it. Let's do this. Take all our training documents, cluster them into coherent topics. And many of you here are experts in doing this and know how to do it. So if I gave you a billion words or 100 million words of text, you'd cluster them into 50, 100, 200 topics. And then for each topic, do the same old thing. Right? That's pretty much what is done most of the time. Right? So I wrote it this way. So you'd construct a topic-dependent model. You'd have one bigram model, if you will, for every topic. And so what this is really doing is, if you want to write it a little differently here, you can probably see what's going on in terms of statistics. So what you want is, you want this topic to be a sufficient statistic of everything that you're dropping out. Right? So I call it topic, and topic perhaps has a very fine, detailed, technical meaning in the theory of discourse or whatever it is. Here I'm just using it to mean the sufficient statistic. So what I would like is, I would like a representation of everything over here in the past, which is somehow sufficient for predicting. So that's my notion of topic. So if you ask me, how do you want documents clustered, what all should go in one cluster, I'll say, well, something that once I condition the cluster, I get good probabilities for the next word. If you could do that, that would be great. Of course, we don't really know how to do that, so we do what people always do in IR. We just cluster based on these bags of words representations, which you've heard of both from the two mics and the day. So I'll tell you a little bit more about that. I'll give you my take on it as well. Right? And then, of course, what this does is, this has this unfortunate effect. If I divide up my corpus into 100 topics, I have 100 of the data to train each of my little topic conditional models. And as if the original data sparsity was not bad enough, this makes it worse. So what do people do? Ah, well, you just do some sort of linear combination. And this is like, you know, these are all engineering hacks, if you will, or good engineering, which basically gets it to work. And so this is like, you know, not so bad estimate. And by the way, where do you get these topics? Well, you can either get them manually, because many of these corpora, like the AP wire, come with manual tags that some person assigns to the news wire as it goes by, saying this is international politics, Israel-Palestine, like, you know, death of Arafat, okay, that's that. And, like, you know, assigns a few keywords that set kind of is more or less static locally, but changes over long periods of time. So you get some sort of classification of the things manually. Or, of course, very often we don't really care about the manual labels, since we're interested in this kind of sufficiency, so we might often do it automatically, right? So this is how the training documents get clustered. What about the test utterance? After all, you're trying to recognize what I'm saying on the fly, right? Well, what you can do is, you can look at all the things I've said in the past and sort of find something which is the closest to all the clusters I've created so far. And so in that sense, when we were talking about what is this notion of interpoint distances, that's adequate for something like this. So if you had a notion of document space in which I could compute this, and I could find of these 100 clusters that I've made, which one is the closest to the sentence I'm trying to recognize right now, things might be quite adequate. All right, so that's one thing. And of course, so what that means is that this equation then becomes the probability of WT given T minus 1, 2, 3, and so on, is essentially one probability which is conditioned on some sort of sufficient statistic, another one which is, let's call it a static model or a global model, and you interpolate that. And then of course, this decision of which cluster is the closest, the way I've written it here, it looks like a hard decision or a classification saying this sentence is about this topic. You could sort of sum it out if you were, you know, too Bayesian, you wanted to believe this just is like a nuisance variable, you'd just sum it all up. So both have been tried, and in the literature, there's very little difference between these two, particularly if you have a sufficiently small number of topics, because then the topics tend to be distinct enough that if you're close to one, you're far away from everybody else. So that's typically what's done. And let me see, I might have some results for this. Okay. So let's go into a little bit of detail. And here I think I'll repeat something which the second Michael said about how you go about doing this. So let's create this word document coherence matrix. So let's say I have a vocabulary of capital M words. I have a collection of capital M documents. The words are called W1 to WM. And let's come up with a simple co-occurrence matrix. So Cij says, how many times did the word I or ith word appear in the jth document? So the number of rows equals the number of words in the vocabulary, the number of columns equals the number of documents in a collection, and I get a Cij. So what I'm going to now do is get this entropy-like global weighting of words. For each word I, I'm going to come up with this number epsilon I. If you look at this part over here, this looks like the Shannon entropy. So Cij is the number of times word I appears in document J, and Ci is simply the count of word I in the whole corpus. So this is what fraction of the word's total corpus count appeared in the jth document. So what this is doing is, if you think of the word, it's telling you its distribution across documents. Think of one row of the matrix. It's just giving you the row entropy for that particular row. And of course, since there are n columns, this can be at most log n, so you divide by log n, you get a number between 0 and 1. Right? And so 1 minus epsilon then becomes how pervasive is the word. If the word appears in only one document, this entropy is 0, and therefore this is 1. And if a word appears roughly equally in every document, then its entropy is log n, and therefore this is 0. And so it says, words highly selective of individual documents get big weights. Words scattered across all documents get little weights. So this tells you how good a word is at identifying the document it came from. Right, so that's what this number is. So this is sort of, in your notation, this would be some TLX or something like that. Yeah. So that kind of a notation. Right? Okay, so this is what it is. And this is, of course, just the good old relative frequency of the word. So this is how many times it appeared in document J divided by the length of the document J. So this tells you the relative frequency of a word I in document J weighted by its importance or its ability to distinguish between documents. So you get a matrix like this. And so now the columns of this matrix represent all the training documents. And so how do you go about creating these topic clusters that you need in order to build these topic-specific models? You essentially do k-means. Right, so usually you start off with, if you have manual topics, you can use them. Otherwise, you use k-means, you sort of initialize them with some arbitrary centroids, often they're not very arbitrary, and then you just assign each document to its nearest centroid, based on that you recompute the centroids and you reiterate.
And you're setting capital N to 1, N grams become 1 grams here.
At this point they become 1 grams, yes.
But you didn't have to do that, or?
I'll tell you what we do later. This is just to cluster the documents. Remember, I'm creating a training collection, which is clustered by documents. From each cluster, I can still estimate an n-gram language model. That's not precluded. All I'm saying is that when it comes to collecting,
you don't need to use n any bigger than one, nor do the document cluster.
Yeah, well, we did. I mean, okay. You could redefine term more generally, as was done in the morning, and then you could say White House is one term, not the word white over there in the vector and house somewhere else. Like that. Yes, you could do that. We didn't do anything of the sort. This was and of course, what the notion of what is closest is done, at least in the work we've done, using inner products. It's a cosine of the column vector j and the column vector k. You don't care about length, so you sort of put them on the unit scale and all that stuff. And at test time, you take all the preceding words, create a pseudo document out of them, and just pretend that this is another vector to find its closest vector using the same sort of cluster. Right? So this is how the clustering of the training documents is done. This is how, when you have a test utterance, you assign it to one of the clusters, and then you build a n-gram model or Markov approximation from just the cluster, another Markov approximation from the whole space, and then you interpolate the two probability densities, and that's your model. So here are some typical results, and I call them indicative because these are somewhat old results. People have done a lot of things since then. These results are from the end of the year 2000, 1999, and just before that, 98, 99. And by the way, I haven't mentioned too many names here. These are results from my own students and myself, but people who started this work, and at this point I'm just reporting other people's ideas, include, Seymour. Seymour and Rosenfeld from CMU. There's another group, Ayer and Ostendorf at that time from Boston University, Clarkson and Robinson from Cambridge. So there are three or four groups which work on these things. Right? And this particular work is, these particular numbers are from a paper that a student of mine, Jinhu, and I wrote some years ago. So what is this? How do you measure the goodness of this? Well, you hold out some data. In this case, we had 2.1 million words for training the language model. So the global model gets trained with all these words. We group them into 70 topics. In other words, we didn't came in with 70. Why is that? Well, this happens to be transcripts of telephone conversations between people. It's sort of a strange collection. They wanted to create data, but they being the National Security Agency, to do some research on speech recognition of spontaneous speech. So they paid people $5 and said, talk about Social Security. Mm-hmm. Talk about gardening. Talk about, they gave them one of 70 topics. People talk to each other. They went through a central switchboard where everything is recorded. That's probably why it gets the name switchboard. And they were transcribed. So since they had 70 topics assigned to people, we started with k equals 70. And we set aside about 18, 20,000 words to sort of do the validation on, or these numbers on. And finally, the vocabulary is about 20, 22,000 words. Right? So typically, you would measure the goodness of fit by just computing the likelihood of held out data. And this is not too far from it. So this over here is the log likelihood. There's a 1 over n, so this is sort of the average log likelihood per word in the test data. There's a minus sign to say that big is bad, small is good. And then 2 to the minus n simply gives you something which is called perplexity. So if you think about it, if the perplexity is 16, what it means is you're looking at, on an average, 4 bits worth of entropy. So it's sort of giving you the number of equal choice. And if you think of the recognizer, this is roughly the number of equally likely words the speech recognizer might consider at that. So that's the reason why it gets its name. I believe it gets it from IBM, right? Yeah, so that's fine. So in terms of perplexity, if you just looked at the good old n-gram model, it has a perplexity of some 83 or 84. If you now create a topic-specific unigram model, why would you do that? Maybe you don't have enough text in any particular cluster. So you may not have enough data to estimate a reliable trigram model. So if you just do unigrams, you get a little bit of a reduction in perplexity. Remember, small is good, but if you build a bigram, it gets a little bit better. Trigram, it gets a little bit better. Sort of things plateau out over here. We went to 4 grams. Doesn't make any sense. Right? So yeah, so there is something to be gained from topic. But what is interesting here is that we are using topic in a very crude sort of way. We're using it to cluster these documents. And after that, we're forgetting everything about these document representations. After that, we march right in and build our good old models. Mm-hmm. So we tried a couple of variations on this. And here, we're going to change the focus of our research. So at this point, I'm not so interested in getting clusters of documents or document representations, but asking the question, how do I then take this representation and use it to modify this probability? In other words, if I now put at the back here a variable tau, which is the topic of everything that came before it, how does that influence the next word? So this is sort of the twist on the problem that I want you to sort of start thinking about. In other words, document representations which somehow capture how they influence the probabilities of words that follow. So this is a very frequentist kind of question, right? And this has nothing to do with classifying documents. I just want to know what's the probability that this word will show up next in a particular context, mind you. So in that sense, it's a little more sensitive than the terms and might even be different from the terms you use for clustering the documents. All right, okay. So one of the things we did is we said, okay, let's do something which is in the flavor of maximum entropy. So in other words, over here, in this model that I just showed you results for, you use something like this. In other words, you try to modify the probability of every word in every context, no matter whether it's a grammatical function word like the, off, or whether it's a real content-bearing word like I'm not. plasma or HIV or something like that. So what we did is we said, okay, once we have these topic clusters, let's do something very simple. Let's compute this simple likelihood ratio. Let's look at, F by the way represents relative frequency or p hat of, for those of you who use that notation. It's just like, you know, the count, number of times you were seen by some denominator, which is the sum of all the words. So for every word, let's find out its relative frequency in documents of a particular cluster, cluster tau, and its frequency in the whole corpus, the relative frequency. So this is like the unigram probability of the word in the corpus and in the subcorpus of a particular topic. And if this happens to be fairly large, meaning it's either much more likely or much less likely than otherwise, and for example, the British National Corpus nouns you're telling us about were probably nouns whose relative frequency in Enron was much different from the relative frequency in the DNC. So if this number is very large, I'll say, okay, this is a topic unigram, meaning this word has something to do with this topic, either positively or negatively, right? Either it happens more often or just doesn't happen. And then I'll go about and collect corpus-wide relative frequencies for n-grams and topic conditional relative frequencies of all the unigrams, right? And once I have these, I'll construct a family of models that agrees with this, these marginals. What do I mean by that? Well, what I mean is that I'll consider a model, and now this is a model on word triples, if you will, or in fact, word triples plus topic. So these four tuples, the marginal probabilities assigned to the word triple WXY should be equal to the relative frequency of WXY in my corpus, to word pairs, the relative frequency of the pairs, to single words, the relative frequency. And then, for every word in a particular topic, I want the model to assign a joint probability equal to its relative frequency in this clustered corpus. Right? And of course, I won't do this for things which I've seen only once. I might ignore a few so that I have a little bit of freedom. And essentially, based on this, I'll define a family of joint PMFs on these four tuples. And once I've got this family, I'll say, okay, everything in this is admissible. And this, by the way, is what I call a linear family, meaning if I take any two probability mass functions which have all these constraints, and I interpolate them, I still get something which, of course, satisfies all these constraints. So in this linear family, I will then choose the probability mass function of the highest entropy. So this is the standard maximum entropy principle. There are lots of justifications for it in at least half a dozen papers. And this basically is what I'll use as my model. Of course, this entails computing a giant partition function on four tuples, but people some years ago, maybe in the early 90s or mid-90s, found a way around it by saying, well, what we really care about are the conditional probabilities. So let's really look for a conditional model. And so there's a little trick. I won't go into too many details. I'll just say that the resulting model has this exponential form. Right, so let's look at this form carefully. So the conditional probability of y given wx, meaning I'll see a word triple wxy in the topic tau, is some form which has e to the sum of these features g sub j with weights lambda sub j. And these features g sub j typically are the unigram constraints that we have over here, some features corresponding to bigram constraints, some corresponding to trigram constraints, and yet others corresponding to what I call topic unigram constraints. Right? So these are the ones that say the frequency of this word in this particular topic should be such and such. Right? And of course, there's a normalizing constant, so this sort of becomes your partition function, except that this now needs to be summed only over the vocabulary, and there is one such thing for every history you care about, so that now when you compute with this model, you only compute for the histories that you actually care about in the test. Okay. So we have this, and this also, by the way, simplifies the computation in estimating the lambdas, because you again compute these only for the histories actually seen in your training samples, not over all possible word triples in the world. So this word is the same. Right, so far so good. By the way, interrupt me with questions if I'm going too fast.
And if you set eta on the last slide to zero,
right,
then you'll get the, that'll degenerate to the non-topic case.
If I set this to zero,
then everything
is in
word is in each topic, and so you won't have any topic conditional structure?
No, I would probably end up getting a partition of 70 different models, because I'm constraining their overall probability, plus I'm constraining their probability in individual clusters. So I'm saying I want it in this cluster to be so much and overall to be so much, but the overall is made up of these pieces, and I'm constraining each of them. So except when I drop a constraint because of infrequent counts, I'll essentially be getting 70 different models. So it would be too constraining.
Right, if eta were infinity, then it would.
If eta were infinity, you'd be back to your
right.
Then you'd constrain nothing, absolutely. So infinity is the limiting case. Which, okay. All right, so this is the model. And by the way, those of you who know maximum entropy will remember, of course, that if, instead of doing all this, if I just said, forget about all this, let's just look at this parametric family. And from this parametric family, let me try to find the maximum likelihood estimate for these parameters alpha based on my training data, I'd get back the same model. So we can take this alternate view for the rest of the talk, if you like. Right? So in other words, we set up a parametric family based on the features that we care about, and then from that parametric family, we just find the maximum likelihood estimate. One way or the other, this is the model. And what this model does is it has a nice way of combining things. Now, like, you know, you don't have to chop up your corpus into 70 different pieces. You just want to maximize the likelihood of the whole corpus. And some of the features depend on topic, others don't. And you just, like, you know, crank and out comes the model. So here are some results for that model. And so this is sort of the trigram model, the WT given T minus 1, T minus 2. This is the perplexity. It's the same corpus. There are about 3,000 conversation sides, and I treat each of them as a document. And then there's a pre-existing vocabulary of 22,000 words. We perform k-means, as I said before, with 70-odd topics. But then we train this maximum entropy model, or we find the maximum likelihood from this family of exponential models. And then for the test utterance, you assign a topic potentially to each new utterance, although the topic assignment doesn't change as fast as it was later.
How good are your topics with k-means that you do?
Okay, so what we found is that in this particular corpus, we started off with these 70 topics with their manual labels as the seed. And then something like a third of the documents actually switched topics. And so, but on the other hand, and I think of the 70, three clusters vanished. Because in other words, they all were closer to something else than to their own centroid, even though manually they were assigned to a particular topic. So three or four of them vanished. But of those that were left, each original cluster still had a majority of topics, documents which were from that topic. So in some sense, people stuck to the topic most of the time. So that's the efficacy of the clustering, if you will.
Oh, you're arguing that it's that this because these topics are really the topics.
I mean, these are really the topics.
Right. But yeah. You're arguing that so I was surprised by how much changing you were describing.
Right.
But you're arguing that that's not bad clustering performance, it's because the actual speakers strayed off topic.
A couple of things happened. Firstly, the speakers stray off topics because they were told to talk about gardening. And they suddenly go to discover that they're Cubs fans. And
yes.
So they start talking about
okay,
baseball.
Okay.
But these were strangers.
Right.
And the other kind is that
and they're only paying $5.
Exactly. Right. And the thing is that nobody checked that they spoke on it. They've got $5 anyway.
Right.
So.
Right.
So the other reason is that some of the topics are actually not so easy to discern anyway. There was one which was social security, and the other one was healthcare for the elderly. So, you know, you expect a lot of overlap in that anyway. People may not even be very clear about whether social security.
So because of this, you can't really answer Rafi's question. That is, there's no way to tell whether the k-means clustering is, quote, working or not. You can't use the true labels. You'd have
to listen
to every conversation.
Right, right, right. And then on the test side, what we found is that for about 80% of the utterances, and we were doing this one for every utterance in the conversation, 80% of the utterances are closer to the no topic model than to any topic. Mm-hmm. And this tells you something about conversations between strangers, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Right? And they were just talking, yep.
Can you say a word about the training and test difference here in this model?
No difference, in the sense that they were all conversations collected over the same period of time.
No, so
the
test, when you say perplexity, you test yourself, in fact, on the same set of data. Mm-hmm.
No, it's separate, meaning there is a set of 1,500 conversations set aside for training, and every year NIST releases a new set of 30 or 40 conversations on which we test. So they're physically separate, but they were all collected in 95 or whenever the corpus was collected, and somebody is the keeper of this corpus and doesn't let us have it. And we get only little chunks, although the switchboard one may have been exhausted by now. But in the language community, there are many such corpora. And every year there's an effort to create a test collection to keep us honest. Right.
Which says something about your field.
Anyway, and what is interesting is, like, you know, this is just a little sidebar, that this perplexity of this log likelihood business, you could of course compute it over the whole corpus, or you could look at the things which we call topic unigrams. And on those you see a dramatic reduction in perplexity. There's like a tenfold reduction in perplexity, which is like 3.5 bits or something. Which means that we really got what we were aiming for. We nailed these guys down, right? And of course, in general, if you said, oh, but of course, you constrained these, so of course you're going to win on these. So we did something else. Of this 20,000 word vocabulary, we deemed 600 or 700 as function words. These were words like and, of, the, they were based on this entropy business, like, you know, they were roughly equally prevalent in all documents. So we threw about 600 of them out, or 700 of them. And the remaining 21,300 were called content words. And even on those, you see a fairly large reduction in perplexity, about, like, you know, a 25% relative reduction. So we are getting at the content. So it's in these contexts where, like, oh, the next word is highly unpredictable from its immediate past, but the wider context gives you a clue. Those happen to be these words. And the other words, like of, the, and, it makes no difference to them whether you know the topic or not.
Yeah. So what's the difference between the top table and the bottom table? I must have missed something.
OK, the top table is the overall perplexity and the error rate of the test corpus. Now, within the test corpus, every word is marked as either a topic unigram or not.
This is the breakdown of
this perplexity, this perplexity over here and this perplexity over here. So although this looks like a small reduction in perplexity, it's all coming from predicting these content words a little better. And same over here. This is the same as this. In other words, this times 25% plus this times 75% should give you that. And because 25% of the word, by the way, this is another thing about conversation, only 25% of the words you speak carry in the meaning. The rest of them are off and
Could you give me an idea of how happy I should be if I see perplexity of 73.6?
Okay, so think of it this
way.
Happy
or angry?
You should say, this task looks manageable. Because remember, the uniform distribution would have a perplexity of 22,000. So think of a distribution on a set of size 22,000. And the average log likelihood of whatever is like.
How much worse is that than 78.8?
It makes enough. These differences in recognition are statistically significant. By the way, that's something I said earlier on, that we haven't made a whole lot of progress in the sense that we claim this is progress because we've reduced error. No, it might be worthwhile because the words that we did a post hoc analysis and the words we recognize are in fact useful words, words which have helped somebody searching and so on. But these are typical in the speech recognition literature, if you can get a 1% reduction. What is not typical is, like I said, these results are about 5 years old, and the error rate on this corpus is now down to about 20%, or a little bit better. So, but then the relative improvements are still the same from these techniques. So that part of it still holds.
This involves both audio processing?
This part involves the audio. This part doesn't. So if you were doing statistics, you'd be happy just looking at these numbers,
okay.
And you wouldn't worry about it. And a big component in this is the acoustic model, mm-hmm. which actually does most of the real work, actually. Because after all, this information is in the speech. You see.
At the end of the day, it's all in the acoustic, right? I mean, if you could have perfect prediction in some sense, you wouldn't, or recognition, you wouldn't need any of your.
You'd be surprised how bad the acoustics can be.
I agree with
yeah,
that.
Yeah, but no. What I mean is, even in clean conditions, the way people speak,
right.
To give you an example, this is an unrelated result. But if you phonetically transcribe what people are saying, and it was done in the same corpus, you have like, you know, a dictionary way of pronouncing the word probability or probably. Most people will say probably. There's a dictionary way of saying everybody, and then the person would say everybody. And so if you start looking at the phonetic units, the rate at which people actually pronounce the phones they're supposed to is about 66%. So one phone in every three is pronounced wrong. And a typical word has like, you know, two syllables, which is like, you know, 4 to 5 phones. So in every word, you have a phonetic error, roughly. So to think that the acoustics can do it all by themselves is sort of not so accurate.
Hmm.
And in terms of the number of parameters or the degrees of freedom, I would say that in a typical recognizer, the acoustic models have a few tens of millions of free parameters, and the language models have a few million free parameters of almost the same order of magnitude. So I think the burden is on both sides.
But so you assume that the previous words were okay, that you actually got.
Oh, no. This is real recognition. You assume whatever you got out of the hypothesis.
Okay.
So the previous word was wrong, and that messes up your next prediction, so
mm-hmm.
So these are honest burden, the real recognizer doing it stuff. For this part, we actually look at the reference transcript. So this part is done on what was actually said. So that's why I said, if you're just looking at held out data and doing statistics, this is what you would look at. So here you do look at the real words. But in this part, you just go with whatever came out of the next.
Yeah, I'm a little confused. Is it the actual words that were done, was there not a language model that was used in from the phonemes to get the word, or is it
Oh, no, no, there is a model, a lexical model, which says how this word is pronounced as in the terms of phonemes, and then there's an acoustic model which says how the phonemes, how the acoustics of the phonemes sound, and they're all composed together in one big model. And the back end of that model chain, if you will, is the word sequence model,
yes,
which is what we are examining here. And everything in front is being held fixed.
Okay, and that's usually what's used to get the error rate down, is that the word sequencing model.
People work on both. I mean, like, you know, there are lots of bells and whistles which are not in this build, in this model. So for example,
as you were saying before, the people tend to mispronounce it.
Oh, there's a statistical component even in that. Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
If you look at the next best choice of
yeah.
the language model, how will you change the error rate? If I allow also the second one to be agreed to it.
Okay, so when we did these experiments, we had 1,000 hypotheses from the recognizer to re-rank. We weren't really considering every possible word sequence, just for expediting the experimentation. And if I went and, as an oracle, chose the best possible hypothesis amongst 1,000, I wasn't allowed to take words from different hypotheses, but I could take any one of the 1,000 sentences that were hypothesized. I would get an error rate reduction of 15% or so, a significant reduction. So the list is fairly good. And that number today is less than 5%. Error rate, meaning 95% of the words in one of the hypotheses in the top 1,000, there is one that has less than 5% error rate. And humans disagree in transcribing the speech to the order of 2 or 3 or 4%. So you're down where the recognizer pretty much has its alternatives in the top 1,000. It just still doesn't know how to pick the right one yet. To that extent, the model is okay.
Sounds is a lot, no? Compared to the complexity of 78.
No, I'm talking about 1,000 sentence hypotheses, and now they will often agree on most of the words where the speaker spoke clearly. So there would be every 4 or 5 words, there would be an island where you'd have a choice between 4 or 5 words. And you say 1,000 hypotheses because you're saying now multiply them out, because that's what the sentence hypothesis is about. Okay. So maybe I'm not characterizing the technology too positively, but it's fairly good. Okay, any other questions? Okay. So this is one approach. And then let's go back to this representation, because then we examined another approach, which I'll use the next 15 minutes or so to explain. Again, the goal here is to take whatever this document representation comes out and then try to use it in some ways to build this conditional model on words, given this long past. Right? And this will go back to a lot of the things, like particularly with LSA, that we talked about earlier. So it's the same thing. I have a word document matrix, as many rows as the vocabulary, as many columns as documents. I take the raw counts, weight each row by this entropy-like term, and then I get the weighted counts. So this is my interpretation, by the way, of SVD. So this is SVD as viewed from the eyes of an engineer. Right? So you have a rank R approximation of this matrix, right? So you have U, S, V transpose. So this is your U, this is your S, it's a diagonal, and this is V transpose. Colors are doing something funny, but let's
have a board
diagonal. No, it's not banded. Only it's diagonal. This is the limit of my PowerPoint. All right. So now, the reason I think SVD works is because this is what happens, right? So think of each. This is the document, right? This is your document vector. So think of each document as a linear combination of some prototypes, which are columns of U. So columns of U become your concepts or your topics, and then S, V transpose is sort of the weights with which you combine them. So these are sort of the meta documents, if you will. And somebody asked a question, what do these look like, right? You can't make head or tail of them. So was it your question earlier in the morning? So these, for example, I think you're right, that these tend to be pretty dense, meaning they have, these are very sparse columns. These tend to be fairly dense, but not very dense, but still fairly dense. And they have negative values in them. And so we tried looking at some of them. They don't make a whole lot of sense. So that if you wanted to interpret them, don't do SVD. It's not worth playing that way. But on the other hand, I don't want to interpret them. I just want to. Same with words, right? Each word, you look at how it is distributed across all these documents, right? And so the way I want to think about it is that, different documents might be about different topics. So there might be some documents about financial stuff, others about nature and trails, and others about basketball, and bank might have 3 different senses in them, right? And so what you hope to expect is that the distribution of the word bank will be made up of some documents that have to do with financial stuff, some that have to do with basketball. So you think of this row as being made up of a linear combination of one of these rows, one of these rows, and one of these rows. Right? And so in some sense, you're hoping that this V transpose, the columns of the V matrix, are essentially locking onto the polysemic words, trying to get a little column one for each sense, and so on and so forth. But again, if you go and try to interpret these, at least for this corpus, we couldn't make a whole lot of sense. I suspect that now that you've asked the question, one of the things I could do is create an artificial corpus, perhaps by duplicating the document a few times with minor perturbations, and then see if indeed these senses fall out of it. But anyway, that's that. So these things are useful. And as a result, of course, this is how you would represent the word. What is nice between these two is that this gives you a way to represent a document in a space of this dimension. It's namely the weights with which you combine the basis vectors U. In other words, you're projecting the document on this basis of vectors. And then here, you're projecting the distribution of words across these documents on this basis of vectors. What is nice about them is that they both are the same size. They are size R projections. And this is essentially what attracted us to SVD. So this is, of course, the standard way of comparing documents. You look at the cosine of the sort of the reduced representation of the documents. This is how you can compare two words. Again, these are inner products. And this, if you remember, is just the projection of the words distribution of across documents into this lower dimensional space. What is interesting to us is this guy. Right? What this is, if you think about omega ij, this is sort of the modified frequency of the word, ith word in the jth document. Its reconstruction is approximately the ith row of U times this diagonal times the jth column of V transpose. And so what this does is it gives us a way to compute sort of the distance, if you will. It's not a metric, of course, but whatever it is between a word I and a document J. What this means is that now if I can cluster all these documents in my corpus into these little topic clusters, and I want to know the affinity of this word to this cluster, I don't necessarily have to sort of, you know, do any building of models based on that cluster. I can just look at this number and say this is how similar this word is to this document. And this was the idea used, again, not originally by me, but a couple of other people whose names, I think I have them in the slide, but one was Jerome Bellegarda, who's at Apple, and the other are a pair from University of Colorado, Noah Cocaro and Dan Jurafsky. So they used this idea, this notion of the distance between a word and a document, again, to build language models. So what did they do? Well, they said, let's do this. We want to approximate this extended history by some notion of a pseudo document. So let's look at everything in the past from t minus 1 backwards and call it d tilde of t minus 1. And let's look at this as a prospective candidate. So what is this? This is the similarity between this word and the extended past that you're looking at in your conditional model. And let's just normalize it out. And like, you know, do we want to do this? Or something like that. You know, words which are more similar to the extended past should have higher probability than others. And what they did is they in fact not do this, because remember this k is a cosine, so it goes from minus 1 to 1. So they took out the minimum, so floored it up, so it was up. And then they found that its dynamic range wasn't large enough to their liking, so they raised it to some exponent gamma. And Jason, was that your idea that exponentiation does something interesting or whatever?
Oh, anyway. You're talking about deterministic annealing.
Yeah, anyway, so they did something like this. And anyway, this is what they used, right? Interesting. And they tried many variations on it. So one thing they tried is they said, OK, once we have this model, let's again go back and do the same old thing. This, mind you, is now a unigram-like model, because it takes the entire, or maybe if you want to call it a bigram-like model, because it takes the entire past and collapses into one variable, which again takes a few dozen or 100 odd values. And although this lives in continuous space, sort of the effective number of things you see in a particular training corpus is as many as there are samples in a training corpus. Anyway, so they do this, and then they try this. They call this linear interpolation. It doesn't work so well. Then they tried something else, which they call information-weighted arithmetic mean. They said, well, this probability will be useful for words which are strongly correlated with topics and not for others. So let's do this interpolation where this interpolation weight depends on the word in question. So you take this and, like, you know, if it's a word which has a very informative nature, remember epsilon big means it's spread all over the place, so it's not very informative. So if it's not a very informative word, don't give this part of the model a lot of weight, just go with this. if it's a very informative word, give this part of the module a lot of weight. It depends on W. And of course, this messes up the interpolation, so they have to be normalized. Tried something with this. Works a little bit better, not a whole lot. They tried something like this. They said, how about just modulating this, multiplying with this? You know, these are, I guess, they were in the mood to try a few different things. I can't figure out quite why they did these. If you can, let me know if there's a nice interpretation of what they're doing. And then this is another one where they said, okay, let's exponentiate these. Like, you know, this is like interpolating log probabilities and scale probabilities. So they tried a few things. So we looked at this and said, nah, that doesn't sound right. Let's do something different. So what we did is we said, okay, let's define this as a feature, right? And put it back in our exponential model. Mm-hmm. Right? So now we have an exponential model where we have the usual unigram, bigram, trigram features, and then we have one feature which looks at the, what was the word? Proximity of the next word to its extended past. Mm-hmm. I used to call it similarity, but today I found a better word, proximity. Right, so this measures the proximity. And then, of course, just go ahead and do maximum likelihood estimation. Except that in everything we've been doing, these parameters have been specific to the feature functions, and now this feature function can take a continuum of values. So this does pose a bit of a problem because we haven't done that in the past with words. We've always treated words as discrete things. So what do we want to do about the fact that this d tilde is continuous? Well, we said, first thing, who says there has to be a different alpha for every one of these? Let's just fix the alpha. So your dependence on topic is governed by this alpha. The more affinity a word has for a particular topic, for a fixed alpha, its probability goes up, relatively speaking. And the less affinity it has, it goes down. And this should remind you of this similarity-modulated engram that these guys have made. So this was the best interpretation I could come up with about what they were doing in some sort. Right, okay, so anyway, we computed this model, we estimated, so there's only one extra parameter
right
now.
Right.
Cracked it up, got results. It is okay. Then we did something else. We said, well, we can limit a few different things. So let's make this alpha, let's have one alpha for every W. So different words have different propensities for being affected by topic. So perhaps what will turn out is that words which don't care about topic will have small alphas, others will have large alphas, so that as soon as a conditioning event comes about for which they have high affinity, their probability will go up more. So there's yet another parametric model. Now this has 20,000 more free parameters than before. Of course, there were already several hundred thousand over here, I think 250,000. So 20,000 more is not a big deal. No, if you come to language modeling, you have to get used to millions of parameters. There's no way out. I mean, your vocabulary size is 50,000, so what are you going to do? So another 20,000 is a drop in the bucket. So we said we'll take it. And this model, again, we trained it up. It takes a few days to compute, but we got the models. And there's one thing you'll learn from the speech recognition community. If you have like a million words, if you have like, you know, 5 million documents, that's easy. If you have a billion documents, okay, then we'll worry about computation. Okay, so here we are. And this model, by the way, I think is comparable to this other model that we were looking at earlier. So this business where they did the log linear interpolation, that's what this sort of looks like. Right, so these are sort of analogs of what has been done and what I think they could have done.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, uniformly, these models do relatively better than these. Right? So that's the nice thing about trying to work it out and seeing that it's laid out properly. All right, third thing we tried is we said, okay, maybe we can, like, you know, the bothersome thing is this continuous value d, right? So let's just quantize it. And how many centroids? Well, the good old stuff, as many topics as you like, 50, 100, 200, a few hundred. So let's say I have 100 of these. So like, you know, that's 20,000 words times another 100. You might think there are a lot of parameters now, but no, not really. Because remember, in this model, we're going to constrain only the probabilities of things which we have relatively enough samples of. So even though I have 100 times 20,000 more potential free parameters, there isn't a feature function for each and every one of them. I put them in only for words which appear at least a couple of times in every topic. So we ended up adding something like only, in fact, in the first case, we didn't really add 20,000 parameters, we added more like 5,000. And in this case, I think we may have added 20 or 25,000 parameters, right? So that's this model. And this now has more degrees of freedom. And this, I don't think, has a comparable analog in what people have done. And of course, for quantizing the document representations, we went back to our good old k-means. Again, I don't think it's necessary to follow any particular clustering algorithm. You can do any your favorite algorithm here, and it'll be fine. Right? And then we looked at one more possible thing, but this we, oh, actually, yeah, here's an interesting point. So if you look at this, let's say that in computing this distance between W and D, for some word in the vocabulary and some extended past collapsed into some D, this might be a continuous valued thing. If I replace this instead with its distance from the nearest centroid, it actually gives me a lot of robustness. And I might have a picture later on to show you how this estimate of the affinity of a word to its extended past turns out to be more robust than this one. Because remember, we're looking at recognition output. So very often, there are errors in the recognition. So what this quantization does is it smooths out over those errors. So this actually turns out to be, even though it's an approximation to the true affinity of W to its history, in the speech recognition context, it actually turns out to be better. So we do that. And then another thing we said is, oh, we have too many words which have some small affiliation or affinity to their past, which are not going to make a big effect on the model. So let's just float them to zero. So we have sort of a minimum below that, everything goes to zero. Right? If you do that, something very interesting happens. So like, you know, if alpha is going to be raised to either zero because the affinity is very small or to k, then it's just like saying alpha to the k is going to be raised to zero or one. So this has really now become a binary feature saying, is this word sufficiently affected by this topic? And we're back to our topic unigram thingy that we had earlier. So this model actually is identical in form to the other model. So let me see. Yeah, here we go. So this guy, if you do the simplification that I just told you, is exactly the same as this guy. And sure enough, when we actually implemented the two models differently and went through it to the end, we got almost identical results. There were minor differences because of the way this quantization was done. It turned out to be a little different. So the set of topic conditional words turned out to be a little bit different and so on. But by and large, there was no difference. Right? And there's a fourth option which we did not try. And this, by the way, is known to give good results based on the previous word that I mentioned of Coccaro and Dalagarda, where what you do is you also cluster your word vocabulary. The reason why this helps is because very often, not just one word has affinity to topics in the past, but whole groups of words do. Right? And you may have seen evidence for one of them being affected by topic and not the other. You may have seen Monday, Wednesday, and Friday appear very often following these two words, but Tuesday and Thursday follow them too, because they're all days of the week, and I will meet you on could be any of the weekdays. Maybe less likely Saturday, Sunday, but nonetheless the week, and so on. So this is something which we have not done. But this formalism that I just outlined to you is nice, because now you can put word classes in here simply by tying parameters. Mm-hmm. So you say these other words, like Wednesday and whatever, Tuesday and Thursday, will have the same alpha parameter as Monday, Wednesday, Friday. Even though I don't have enough word counts to constrain their probability, I'll constrain their total class probability. And here are some numerical results. This is again the baseline saying the trigram model gives you 78, and the maximum entropy with only trigram also gives you 78.9. And if you do this LSA stuff, you get 73.6, you get small reductions. And since I'm running out of time, I'll just make a quick comparison of those two methods. They're almost identical. So we sort of came to the same model in two different ways. Namely, they have roughly, they both use cosines for computing, which is the topic in prevalence at test time. They both use k-means to cluster the documents in order to do all these statistics. It's just that one of them has a 20,000 dimensional vector space and the other one has 73. So if you want to design a PDA, you would probably use this one. And so there's a big dimensionality direction. In this case, like I said, two or three topics vanished because of insufficient counts. In this case, most of them vanish. So when you do the clustering in lower dimensional space, for some reason you get much tighter clusters. And we looked at the clusters. Most of them made sense, some of them didn't make any sense, but we said this is what the algorithm gives us, we'll take it. The number of words per topic, remember I said if a word has a relatively high probability in the topic or relatively too low probability compared to the rest of the corpus, we'll do it. So the number of, how many topics does a word end up being a topic word for? Typically no more than two. And then in any given topic, we have several topic conditional words, so summed over all 70 topics, we have either 15,000 or 19,000 words, and you get similar reduction.
That's an interesting table, don't you think? I mean, if you just looked at the performance, you know, many things are kept constant, the cosine and the k-means, and if you look at the performance, the vector space dimension doesn't affect it at all.
Yes.
So that tells you
That tells me that I really don't need such a high dimensional space to extract the granularity of statistics that I'm looking for.
But it's not hurting you.
It's not hurting me, yes, that is true.
Which is, that's what surprises me. There must be a reason why it's not hurting you.
What does it do? It helps me cluster, and the other thing it does is lets me have an extended history at runtime, at test time, and figure out which of these 70 or 100 clusters I'm close to. And for that, it may not hurt, unless there are severe recognition errors at giving you words which take you off in the wrong direction. So this might be consistent with something else, namely that when you do information retrieval, if you're trying to retrieve speech instead of text documents, and if your accuracy is something above 60%, it makes almost no difference whether you're retrieving from the manual transcripts from the speech recognizer output. So it might be that when you have a 100-word window to decide which topic this conversation is about, the dimensionality of the vector space may not hurt you too much. And the number of topics are small, remember the 60, 100. Yeah.
Additional complexity is this one
a
much
lot
faster.
Better. Yeah, because you know, just sheer implementation. I mean, there are tricks to speed this up because you're talking of fairly sparse representations, but then it requires some clever programming. And the student who did this didn't want to do clever programming, so he just said, okay, yeah, so I would say this appears to be a whole lot bigger in the beginning, but in reality it's not that much bigger.
Right.
If you can do clever things like use the sparsity of the vectors, yeah?
Have you tried ranks smaller than 73, lower dimensions,
This was a good question. This was asked when I first presented this at one of the speech conferences. In fact, the question there was the other way. Why didn't we go much above 73? Because people think there are gains to be had all the way to a couple of hundred. We tried, I think, 25, and the performance was not good at all. And we sort of didn't spend too much time trying to figure out the dimensionality of the space. Our motivation here was mainly that we had some 70-odd topics to begin with. So we just said, let's believe that, and maybe it wasn't a good belief. I don't know. I would just say, sorry, I don't know the answer to that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're out of time, maybe. Well, anyway, I'll put up the slide, but I won't say.
No.
All right, any other questions?
Thank you, Sanjeev.